You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, from some of the first ever girls to join the Eagle Scouts are from Wisconsin. We talked to a pair of sisters who reached the BSA's highest rank. Now, five women have accused New York Governor Andrew Cuomo of sexual harassment in and out of the workplace, including unwanted advances, kissing, and repeated discussions about their romantic lives. Some of that alleged behavior took place just in the last year, well after the Me Too movement brought more visibility to the issue of sexual harassment in the workplace. New York's Attorney General has started an investigation into the claims. In the meantime, some but not all prominent Democrats in that state have called for Cuomo's resignation. Meanwhile, Republican Congressman Madison Cawthorn and Ronnie Jackson have also seen recent reports of past harassment. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think that things have changed at the workplace or in politics since the Me Too movement went into high gear a few years ago? Have you noticed a culture shift in your own workplace? In the case of politicians, should sexual harassment, in effect, disqualify people from staying in office? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Jennifer Drobeck is a professor at Indiana University's Robert H. McKinney School of Law. She's an expert on sexual harassment law and consent law and is the author of several books on the topic. Jennifer, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here.
Well, there have been a few high-profile cases. Governor Cuomo in New York, the highest profile. As you have followed the reporting on that story, what are your thoughts on it?
Well, I think it's really important to wait and see what comes of the investigations. As we know, these are allegations, and the alleged perpetrator and others have called for an investigation. And so that needs to happen. In this country, we have a presumed innocent until proven guilty standard for criminal law that usually rules in civil law, although the standards are different, but I think we need to know more.
Last week, Governor Cuomo addressed the allegations. Here's a listen to a bit of what he had to say.
I fully support a woman's right to come forward, and I think it should be encouraged in every way. I now understand that I acted in a way that made people feel uncomfortable. It was unintentional, and I truly and deeply apologize for it.
And Jennifer, that sense that he made people uncomfortable with his behavior, that's stepping away from, I guess, the legal or civil liability side of things and into the workplace culture side of things. Do you think that with the high-profile Me Too movement, that there's been awareness of a changing expectation of how we behave in the workplace?
Yes. I've heard that people say, well, given hashtag Me Too and Time's Up, why is this still happening? Mm-hmm. And my first response to that is that cultural change is a bit like an aircraft carrier. It is slow to turn and modify. And so we need to be patient as these changes do occur, as we turn the ship, so to speak. But the ship is turning. If you look at the popular, now decades-old, TV show Mad Men, about an advertising agency, and Don Draper and Elizabeth Moss and John Hamm were in it, that show, I think, accurately portrayed rampant sexual harassment at work. That type of behavior wouldn't exist in today's workplace. And the fact that we're having such open and meaningful conversations about this topic means that change has occurred and will continue to occur as long as we take steps to keep the ship moving in the right direction.
Now, I know the legal system has changed on some of these issues since the time of Don Draper's real life counterparts. In the year since 2017, when it wasn't when the Me Too concept started, but it was when it went really high profile, have we seen legal changes when it comes to protections from sexual harassment in the workplace?
Yes, some. And ironically, Andrew Cuomo has been one of the instigators of that change. For example, the federal standard is that in order to be actionable in a court of law, sexual harassment has to be severe or pervasive. My understanding of New York law is that Mr. Cuomo advocated for that severe or pervasive level to be dropped from New York state law. And I think that that change was enacted for the human rights law of New York in 2019. So with the amendments going into effect in 2020. So change is occurring. There have been a few bills to go through Congress sort of modifying and making changes, including in tax law regarding non-disclosure agreements and other minor aspects of these cases. Is more change needed? Absolutely. But we are seeing some, and I never like to dispute at least some progress.
We're talking to Jennifer Drobak from the Indiana University School of Law. We are talking about sexual harassment and consent back in the news again in the American political world a few years after the real high-profile Me Too movement came to light. Let's bring out a caller now at 800-642-1234. Anna is with us in Madison. Anna, hello.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. So I work in the sales sector, which is definitely still a field that struggles with sexual harassment deeply. And the Me Too movement has definitely affected it in the sense that my coworkers will say things like, oh, but don't report me to HR. You know, we don't have to make this a big thing. So there's definitely still a need to continue the push forward, especially with older generations who have a higher tolerance for what I would call abhorrent behavior.
And I want to clarify, they'll still say the horrible thing, but then say, oh, don't take me to HR, though. Do I have that
exactly.
right?
Exactly. Exactly. And it'll kind of come out as like a joke. They'll be smiling about it, you know. And there's definitely still cracks about the Me Too movement. Well, we don't need to make it like that. But it's just like, except it does have to go like that. Because as two professionals working equally in a field, we need to be treated at the same level.
Do you feel, Anna, like you have recourse? Is there somewhere you can go where you feel you can safely raise these issues?
Oh, yeah. Well, that's that's a whole different issue. We did actually have an incident with my coworker that was brought to HR, but he still works there. It's a frustrating thing when the levels of power above an employee are still a little bit in an old mindset. You can't change a system if the people on top, the people in power, are the ones making the change because they're still stuck in that mindset. The people who are in power are not for the Me Too movement necessarily.
Anna, thank you so much for sharing that. I'm very sorry to hear that. I guess, Jennifer, I'm not necessarily surprised to hear that. What can a workplace like Anna's and a business, because if you're in sales, you probably work with other companies too, what could they do to change that mindset?
Well, there are a few things they can do. First of all, those people who are in key leadership positions at an organization need to recognize that this phenomenon exists. Some people who enjoy privilege want to keep that privilege, including the privilege to harass. And so these key enlightened individuals need to call on resources that can help steer the ship, that can help create cultural change within the organization. And that means an ombudsperson, perhaps a complaint line, someone to give live in-person training. I'm also working with the idea now in a new paper of treating sexual harassment like a misappropriation of corporate assets, only in this case, it's human assets. That affects the corporate bottom line. It costs money for companies to allow people to harass in terms of absenteeism, low productivity, and other losses, and also to deal with complaints and to defend litigation and to pay people like Roger Ailes and Bill O'Reilly millions of dollars to go away. So it is in an organization's best interest financially as well as morally and ethically to deal with this problem. And once key officials in the organization come close to understanding that, then the change begins to occur more quickly. And what I call the corrupt predators or the cancers within the organization, they get excised. Now, if I may, there's a problem with what's going on in the case of Governor Cuomo is that while I don't think that he's on the level of Harvey Weinstein or Roger Ailes, I'm not sure what category he's in the two lesser categories. I say that the first is clueless. The clueless don't really realize that what they're doing is wrong or having a negative impact on people. But once they're informed, they get it and they're remorseful and they say they're sorry. And those people don't need punishment. They need training and education because they will reform. The second category is the careless or could not care less. They know what they're doing is wrong. They do it anyway because they're getting their jollies from it or some sort of a lift or emotional satisfaction. Those people will not reform just with education. They need sanctions, consequences. And that may be true in this case in New York. I'm not sure which it is. And the investigation will help demonstrate which basket we're in. So I think we will know more soon.
Thanks again for that call, Anna, at 800-642-1234. Jennifer Drobak stays with us, professor at Indiana University's Law School, looking at sexual harassment in the workplace and accountability, in part after five women accused New York Governor Andrew Cuomo of misconduct in the last year. Also, just checking in a few years after the Me Too movement got big and drew a lot of attention, not just to the women who are experiencing it, but to the people who are perpetrating it. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think the Me Too movement has done enough to change the workplace culture around harassment? Has anything changed where you work? Are there certain people or job sectors you think the movement hasn't done as much for? And for politicians, what should be done to hold them accountable? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk now with Jennifer Drobak, law professor at Indiana University, expert on sexual harassment law, looking at what's changed and what hasn't in the workplace since the Me Too movement began and got high profile a few years back. Still time for your calls, maybe your experiences or questions at 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls now. We've got Kim on the line in Madison. Kim, hello.
Yes, hi. Can you hear me?
I can. Go ahead, Kim.
Yeah, hi. I just wanted to say that I, you know, not to be disrespectful, but I think this is a somewhat naive way of looking at who benefits and who doesn't and how we're going to stop this kind of behavior. You know, I was sexually harassed from my very first job at the age of 15 and then unfortunately assaulted.
Kim, are you still
and then
there?
I had, yep. Can you hear me?
Yep. Keep going.
Okay. And then I've had like a series of jobs my entire life where I've been harassed at work. And I've worked both in the sales industry and also as an educator. And I've had principals multiple times say really terrible things to me. And I lost a teaching job 1 year. Not so long ago, because the principal said, well, sure, I'd be happy to grant you tenure, but, you know, you have to have dinner with me Saturday night. So it really is very pervasive. And the only way that I was able to get this principal to stop was to go to my union. And once I went to my union, you know, they threatened to take action. And that was really the turning point. You know, really rich people, bosses, corporations benefit from pitting people against each other. And so the idea that, you know, we just have to educate the bosses out of it and then things will get better, I think it's kind of naive. I think women and also everybody who's opposed to sexual assault needs to organize together, and that's really the way we're going to get genuine change. Because if it was just a matter of, like, understanding that what you're doing is wrong, people in the 1970s went through the same exact struggle, right? Women's liberation movement was a real movement. So if it was just a matter of changing ideas, then we would be in a much better position than we are. So there really have to be consequences. And I think unions and a real women's movement, a vibrant movement on the ground where we're demonstrating and marching and demanding appropriate behavior is really what's necessary. I think Cuomo is quintessentially the way that rich white men think of the women who work for them. And Kim, that's how thanks. They treat us. And I think it's disgusting.
Thank you so much for sharing your experience, Kim. And Jennifer, I hear kind of a sense of a need for empowerment, because part of the story here is sexual harassment as an abuse of power. What do you think of what Kim had to say, Jennifer?
Well, I actually agree with Kim completely. And so, but I guess my only friendly amendment would be that it's not just a matter of punitive consequences. We need a full toolbox of approaches to the problem, which includes, as I said before, if you have a corrupt predator, excision from the organization is really the only way to end that problem. If it's somebody who is careless, could not care less, then sanctions absolutely are going to be needed in a graduated fashion. But I think that we don't want to abandon our notion of proportionality. So the consequence has to fit appropriately to the behavior in a graduated fashion. We don't want to cure a problem with a sledgehammer if a minor adjustment will work. Now, sometimes the minor adjustment won't work, and we need to be savvy about when and will it won't. Is this about power? Yes, absolutely. You can't really sexually harass someone unless you have some power. And the more power you have, the better the opportunity you have to harass. So I think we need to recognize that, and that this problem, I don't think, will ever go away completely. But the fact that we are recognizing it, doing something about it, moving forward with more and more appropriate legislation, and I think putting a number on the bottom line as to what it's costing companies, no company wants to keep an embezzler in its midst. And someone who is dealing with an embezzler wants to get rid of that person. And I think that's appropriate also in someone who is taking human corporate assets for their own use and enjoyment, contrary to the best interests of not only that person, that human being, but also the organization.
Kim, thanks for that call. Go to Avalon now in Madison. Avalon, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I think that the Democratic Party has a real problem with Me Too, and this is evident based on, you know, the rampant calls for Cuomo's resignation and an investigation that we did not see for Joe Biden, who has a similar list of allegations against him, ranging from inappropriate touching to sexual assault. And I think that, you know, this is not a court of law, and I understand that there's a, you know, innocent until proven guilty is the standard in a court of law. But when we're talking about politicians, when we're talking about people that have vast power, I think that we need to ask the question, should these people who have these allegations be in office? You know, and I don't think that they should. And I don't think that we're going to see a change in the culture of sexual harassment in the workplace when we have a president who has sexual misconduct allegations after having a Republican president who had the same.
Avalon, thanks a lot for the call. How does an organization, a Democratic or Republican Party or a film company or whatever, make sure they police their own, even though their own is leading them to success in some ways?
Well, to this point, I think Evelyn raises a really important distinction. We're seeing very different responses from people based on political association, party, and timing. And so I'm seeing a double standard. And I'm thinking, was it proportionate for Senator Franken to resign over something that was taken, from a photograph that was taken many years ago? And perhaps he should, but I think that there should be consistency. And I also think that it would be naive, and this is to get back to Kim's point, to think that political opponents won't use sexual harassment. And now I'm making this reference with respect to both and all parties, that they won't use sexual harassment as a tool to undermine a political candidate with allegations. I'm also thinking of the allegations against President Biden. Also to say that the behavior by former President Trump and Governor Cuomo is an equivalent, I think is a mistake. I think with Donald Trump, we had a tape recording of him saying that he felt it was okay to grab women's genitalia and allegations of serious sexual assault. If the allegations of serious sexual assault against the governor are true, then of course that we have more relationship between the two. But I think, again, I think we all are protected by the rules of evidence and the standards that we have under the law. And I would hate to see those eroded because we have a concern that the problem isn't getting solved quickly enough.
And we'll have to leave it there. Thanks to our guest, Jennifer Drobak from the School of Law at Indiana University, looking at sexual harassment at the workplace. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Wisconsin's crowded prisons have been vulnerable targets for COVID-19 with health concerns for inmates and staff. We'll get the latest numbers and hear about efforts to stop the spread in Wisconsin correctional institutions. Now, earlier this year, the Boy Scouts of America awarded the top rank of Eagle Scout to a class that, for the first time, included young women. Among that historic group were several Wisconsinites, including sisters Annie and Casey Scheid of Racine. I talked to them earlier today. I want to ask each of you why you wanted to become an Eagle Scout. Annie, why don't you start us off?
I knew I always wanted to be a part of scouting because what scouting is about has always been a part of our family. My siblings, my older brothers were Eagle Scouts. My grandfather is an Eagle Scout. I have a ton of Eagle Scout cousins. So we've always just, my whole family, extended family, has always been a huge scouting family. And when females were allowed to join scouting, it was just a moment of, oh, wow, I can actually have the opportunity to get the achievement that my family members have received. And I knew it was hard and I knew you would have to work hard for it, but I saw it as like a something I wanted to get, like a reward that I could get. And I knew I always wanted to go for it. And it just came naturally coming from a scouting family.
And Cassie, you're from the same family, of course. Can you talk about, when you decided, not just any scouting, you wanted to pursue that same Eagle Scout path that your brothers and your grandfather had?
So, like Annie said, I always knew that if I had the choice to be or had the chance to be in Scouts BSA, I would take it. So when I heard that scouting was allowing females to go into it, I was driving in the car with my dad and I turned to him and I said, I want to do this. So then we started off and Annie and I were both lucky because the troop that we were in was very set on rank advancing, which is how you become an Eagle Scout. And so I knew like, okay, I can do this. I can rank advance and I can become an Eagle Scout. So basically when I saw that we were going through the ranks quickly, I knew that there was an opportunity for me to do it. And I just decided that that's the path I wanted to take.
and Cassie Annie just mentioned. It is not an easy path to become an Eagle Scout. Could you talk about the challenges that you and I guess any Eagle Scout have to overcome?
Yeah, so scouting is more than just camping. There's a lot of different aspects about being a scout. You have the outdoors aspect, you have a service requirement and service aspect, you have education through merit badges, and you have leadership. And all of those aspects are put into each step or rank towards becoming an Eagle Scout. In each rank, there are different requirements for what you have to do, different educational. You have first aid requirements. You have to earn a certain amount of merit badges. You have to do a certain amount of service hours. You have to hold a leadership position. And there's also time limits. So for me, I entered Scouts and I didn't get the age extension for females and for anyone actually, and even a guy who they joined in February of 2019 and they were like 17 or 18 and they couldn't make the Eagle Scout by the time they aged out. They got an extension, but I didn't make it. So Annie and I were planning out okay, this is when I have to get this rank done. So it's a big aspect.
And Annie, can you talk about what kind of projects you did along the way? Or I think there is the Eagle project you had to do along the way.
Yeah, so me and Cassie like to ring bells with the Salvation Army and during Christmas time. And that was something we got into through scouting. But you do have to complete a service project for your Eagle Scout rank. And you have to demonstrate leadership. And you have to demonstrate that you can handle problems and situations that that life throws at you. You can handle talking to adults and talking with people who are higher up than you. And you have to plan your project and get people to help volunteer for it. And you have to raise money for your project. And it's just your Eagle Scout project is taking everything you learn through scouting, all the lessons and all the skills you've learned, and packaging it into one big project to show the meaning of scouting, which is giving back to your community. And my Eagle Scout project is I built two movable large notice boards, and they are a place for the Racine County Pony Club to post any papers, any show results, show patterns, camp schedules for their different activities there. They have shows, clinics, camps, and they really needed something that would allow them to keep people from going into the barn to find papers and make it easy access, because these notice boards are large enough that you can ride up next to it with a horse. Uh-huh. And this project was something they thought they needed, and I was able to provide it for them.
And Cassie, what was your project?
I built three wooden octagonal picnic tables, also for the Racine County Pony Club, and I placed them on top of a circular mulched area. And they are for a viewing area for the Racine County Pony Club's dressage ring. They didn't really have a good one before, and I knew when I was deciding on a project that I would like this, because club members, spectators, people who come for day camps, family members can just go sit on these these picnic tables and just enjoy being outside and have a nice place to sit.
Can you each take 20 seconds as we wrap up to offer encouragement if there is a young girl out there listening, wondering if Eagle Scouting is right for her? Cassie, start us off.
To that young girl, go ahead and do it. There are multiple troops that are available. Just look into it. It is a wonderful experience. And although you may be feeling shy or you may feel like people will doubt you, just know that everyone's going to doubt you. There will always be people doubting you. There will always be people who don't expect you to go far. You just have to know your own personal self-worth and just believe in yourself and that you can achieve anything.
Annie, anything else you'd add to that for that prospective Eagle Scout?
Yeah, I would tell that young girl, be open to making friends and be open to meeting new people and going to new experiences. Just take full advantage of what scouting will offer you. And if you don't, you won't necessarily have the best time, but you want to take advantage of everything that's available for you. And also, I also want to say, if your troop isn't necessarily the best fit, if you just like don't feel like the troops for you that you're in currently, say they meet on a day that you aren't able to meet, I definitely look for more troops in your area. Just because one troop may not be the right fit for you, you're going to find a troop that you like and you love and you enjoy going to.
Thanks to both of you for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Annie and Cassie Scheid of Racine. They each recently earned the rank of Eagle Scout in the Boy Scouts of America, were part of the first group of young women ever to do so. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Tyler Ditter with a story about an Army Reserve veteran who now lives in Shawano County.
Joanne Shedler's family was fighting in wars long before the U.S. military existed. This is one reason the nurse joined the Army Reserve later in life and eventually co-founded the Mohican Veterans Group. Shedler lives in Gresham and shared her experience as part of StoryCorps' Military Voices initiative.
I was an older nursing student that went to Marquette University in Milwaukee. And after I graduated with my Bachelor's of Science in Nursing, a family member who is an Army recruiter talked to me and said that I could get a direct commission in the Army if I wanted to join it. I thought that was a great opportunity because of the history of my family. As a Native American, we have fought in wars since before the military, U.S. military. I was commissioned as a second lieutenant, which is the bottom ranks of officers. Our reserve unit got called to active duty. We started out at Fort McCoy in Wisconsin. We were in big barracks, and it was very dreary. And so we got a little opportunity to run into Walmart, and I bought some things to help decorate up our bathroom. The other women really appreciated that. I also am a beautician, which I did before I became a nurse, and I offered free haircuts to people because we were there after 4 months, and there was only a barber on the base. And to me, that helped with our morale. And as a leader, I think it showed that you can make the best of whatever situation you're in. I also got a tribal flag that I brought along, and I hung it outside when I got to have a little area where I did have some privacy. And that was kind of cool because it gave a lot of people an understanding that there's Native Americans that are also here. We're a whole variety of people. Parts of our unit were pulled and called up to go to Afghanistan. I volunteered to do that, but by this time I had received my promotion to major. They were looking for ICU nurses, and I was a med surg and administrator at that time, so I did not get the chance to do that. But we stayed on a few more months, and then 2004, I retired after 20 years and 6 months in the Army Reserves. So when I was back home, I became a tribal council person, a legislator for my tribe. As a veteran, I was very interested in our history. So I was a part of our historical society for our tribe. Myself and two other tribal member women who were retired Army, we started the Mohican Veterans about 17 years ago. And so we have our own Mohican Veterans organization. We're formed because we want to recognize and be at all the funerals as honor guards. And we have an Eagle Staff, which is a memorial Eagle Staff that we've started. And my Eagle Feather, one of my Eagle Feathers that I have, when I pass on, my family can give it to our veterans. And then at my funeral, they will tie that Eagle Feather onto the staff. Our veterans group were instrumental also in putting together a veterans memorial. And in front of our clinic, we have a memorial now. And so every day we can see that there with many names that are there. So we continue to honor our veterans many ways.
That was Joanne Shedler of Gresham, Wisconsin. She shared her experience as part of StoryCorps' Military Voices initiative, which is made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Tyler Ditter.
Coming up, while some inmates 65 and older in Wisconsin's correctional facilities have begun their vaccine process, many remain waiting and at risk. We get an update on COVID-19 and the prison system. That's next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. The CDC recommends inmates follow similar guidance to those of us outside the prison walls. 6-foot distances, wear a mask, wash your hands. But there are other factors outside of the inmates' control that have caused high rates of COVID-19 infection and at least 25 deaths in the state's prison system. The communal-style facilities and cramped cells are just a few factors to consider. And while some inmates 65 and older have completed or begun the vaccination process, many remain unvaccinated for the time being. Vanessa Swales is an investigative reporter with Wisconsin Watch. She's been reporting on COVID-19 in Wisconsin's prisons. Vanessa, thanks for joining us today.
No, thank you for having me on.
Vanessa, can you give us a general sense of how bad it was in our prisons over the last year?
Yeah, so the coronavirus has pretty much run rampant across Wisconsin's state prison system, infecting at least 2,491 staff members at adult institutions. And these are self-reported tests, test results. And 10,873 inmates throughout the pandemic. That's more than half of the current prison population. The state has detected infections among inmates at a rate more than 5 times higher than in the general population. The numbers are highly concerning for prisoners, criminal rights advocates, and medical experts, which is, you know, as you look at the numbers, it's obvious why.
And can you talk about why these are such high risk places? I mean, some of it seems obvious. Lots of people living together day after day in a small area.
Yeah. So, I mean, as of March 5th, the state's 19,539 inmates are filling facilities designed to hold only a little more than 17,000 people, individuals. So overcrowding is a huge component. Of the more than a dozen inmates who I interviewed, many said that the main reason for such large rates is overcrowding. Also, the continued use of communal bathrooms, barrack-like sleeping arrangements, day rooms, telephones, along with inconsistent restrictions on gathering and movement, leave prisoners too close to other prisoners and staff, which allows COVID-19 to spread freely. You know, in some cases, some prisoners told me that they witnessed infected individuals not being separated from others or properly quarantined. And, you know, staff not really following the DOC masking mandate, or at least it was uneven and inconsistent in a number of facilities.
There was talk early on from Governor Evers and others about releasing low-risk inmates, low-risk of offending if they were let out of prison, to reduce those numbers, reduce overcrowding. To what extent did that actually happen?
I mean, so Governor Evers' promise, I mean, during his campaign was really, you know, hasn't really been fulfilled, and to the dismay of many advocates. The prison population, however, has been cut by about 3,400 individuals since March 2020. You know, that dip includes the agency's limits on taking inmates from county jails during the pandemic, as well as their early earned release program, which has allowed 2,100 non-violent offenders over the past year to pursue substance abuse treatment instead of prison. And then the release of elderly inmates who also have health conditions, and that's about 16 people. So that's only a sliver of Wisconsin's roughly, you know, 20,000 prison population.
How do we compare to other states in handling this issue?
So compared to Wisconsin, most states have confirmed more COVID-19 deaths among inmates when adjusted for population. But Wisconsin actually ranks eighth in infection rates as of this week. When I reported this story, it was ranking 10th, and this was 2 months ago. And this is data collected and tracked by the Associated Press and the Marshall Project.
And you start your piece off at WisconsinWatch.org talking about the story of Calvin Johnson. Can you tell us about the concerns he tried to raise and how he was ultimately exposed to the disease himself?
Yeah, I mean, his story, I will say, has hit me pretty hard as a journalist and as a person. He was desperately trying to have his sentence reduced due to health issues, health concerns. And he had diabetes, sleep apnea, and he truly felt that he was going to die of COVID. And this was according to his former cellmate, Randy Forsterling. And you know, tracking his particular case sort of almost highlighted why Wisconsin's prisons are designed to be dangerous in some cases. You know, these individuals are in a very confined space. It's not like what's happening in the real world where we are able to actually social distance and separate ourselves from people. So his story really shows the dangerous nature of what's happening inside prisons.
Now, vaccines are going around in the general population, slowly expanding to bigger groups. What's the story of vaccines in Wisconsin prisons, especially for those older or at-risk inmates and, I guess, staff members for that matter?
Yeah, so the latest version of phase 1B of the vaccine rollout, prison populations are being vaccinated. DOC healthcare staff started receiving vaccines in January. Correctional staff are now eligible and being vaccinated. That's about 2,600 staff at least, according to the DOC. But, you know, there are some who are refusing to take to receive the vaccine. When it comes to inmate vaccinations, however, the DOC has been incredibly vague about the exact number, at least when I have been speaking with them. They usually refer me to the Wisconsin DHS vaccine eligibility page, which really doesn't reveal much. But I can confirm anecdotally through interviews with inmates that vaccinations of prisoners 65 years and older began early to mid-February, and that now most, if not all, prisoners are being asked if they want to be vaccinated and are in fact being vaccinated. I would say most want it, but again, some have chosen not to.
You mentioned that some of the tests for staff in particular were self-reported. I mean, to what extent do we know that the data we have about COVID infections and deaths at our prisons represents reality, or are there still gray areas where we're not sure really what's going on?
I mean, so when it comes to the self-reported tests, I mean, it is truly down to that staff member saying that they are not feeling well. So with those numbers, yes, it's a little fuzzy. It's really an honor system. When it comes to inmate deaths, which as it stands right now, it's 25 inmates who have died due to COVID. But I know anecdotally that there are more deaths than have been reported. And to be fair, in some cases, it's due to ongoing investigations being carried out on the deceased by county coroners. And that included Calvin Johnson and Clarence Gibbons, another inmate whose story I reported on. But, you know, for many criminal justice advocates, they fear even more inmates have died and that there is a lack of transparency with these numbers and what's happening behind prison walls. And it's really not telling the truth of what's happening and the risks that these people are being exposed to on a day-to-day basis.
In our last 30 seconds or so, the pandemic, I mean, there's light at the end of the tunnel. It's not over yet. What are you watching for next when it comes to COVID-19 and our state prisons?
Well, really just I'm truly looking and curious as to how many people are going to be having getting the vaccinations. You know, there have been some instances recently in Racine where some officers are refusing to be vaccinated, citing conspiratorial beliefs, such as the vaccine will give them COVID-19, for example. So I'm really tracking how consistent it is being rolled out within the prison system. And, you know, if there are going to be any more outbreaks, that is a concern for many prisoners and their loved ones. So that's what I'll be focusing on.
Vanessa, thanks for sharing this with us today.
Thank you so much.
Vanessa Swales is an investigative reporter with Wisconsin Watch. She's been reporting on the issue of COVID-19 in state correctional facilities. got a link to our article you can find it at WPR.org/Central Time.